Environmental leader and professor of law at Vermont Law School, Gus Speth, will present his new book, America the Possible, when he speaks tonight in Graham Barrington about the future of the United States economy, a system having reached an impasse, evidenced in the headline-making extreme weather patterns, the loss of America's middle class, and exploding ecological catastrophes. Gus Speth will present a hopeful message of the great opportunities before us as we have it in ourselves, he says, to use our nation's pillars of freedom and democracy to build a new economy movement that sustains both people and the planet for generations to come. The Berkshire office of the New Economics Institute is hosting the free public talk at the First Congregational Church in Great Barrington at 7:30 tonight. The name of the book, America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. It's a great pleasure to welcome Gus Speth to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Hello, Joe. It's great to be with you.
Very nice to have you here. It'll also nice to have you in the Berkshires tonight, and I thank you very much for giving us a preview of what you'll be talking about. I think it's just cool when someone of your note and of your experience writes a manifesto.
Well, it's a title that draws attention, thank goodness, and that's important for books. But it's also we really do need a type of revolution in our country, I think, a very peaceful one, and something that won't come quickly. But the truth is that we live and work in a system of political economy that's now delivering bad results across a whole spectrum of issues: environmental, social, political, economic. And we have so many problems, you have to conclude that it is the system that is the problem. And if we want to really build the kind of future that I certainly would like to see for my six grandchildren, and other people I'm sure would like to see for their children and grandchildren, we're going to have to get busy with building a new political economy, something that hasn't existed in history, I don't think, except in pieces here and there, a new political economy that really does give priority to people and to place and to planet. And so the book is mainly about what that future would look like and how do we get there. But it starts with a pretty bleak look at the problems that we now have. Excuse me, go ahead.
No, it certainly is a bleak picture, and I just want to pick up on something that you said early on in your answer, which was that this will take a long time. And I note that both you and Bill McKibben, who were arrested in front of the White House in August of last year, Bill McKibben, who's been on the show many times and is a dear friend, keeps saying, we don't have a lot of time. And I'm wondering, at what point do we have to, I read the book and I know it needs to be done now, but when do we do it? And yeah. And at what point is there an expiration date on this where it becomes too little too late?
Well, we've already exceeded the expiration date on climate change that Bill and I have worked on now for decades, literally. My work on the climate issue, I'm embarrassed to say, goes back to the Carter administration, when I was in the White House, and we put out three reports in the late 70s and going into 1980 on the need for climate action. So we knew a lot way back then, over 30 years ago, and we've done very little. So the fact is that the point the book makes is that we have to walk on two legs. There's some urgent things that have to be done, some catastrophes, really, that have to be prevented now without the time that's going to be needed to really transform a lot of the underlying drivers of our problems. So we need Congress and states to act now to reduce these greenhouse gas emissions urgently and deeply and quickly. But over time, we're also not going to be able to deal effectively with these challenges, including the climate challenge, unless we undergo some deep transformations also. So we need to get started with the reform approaches that we know how to do and have been studied for years. In the meanwhile, we need to get busy building a momentum for deeper transformative change. But just to take a couple of simple examples, you know, dealing with the climate issue over time is going to be, you know, near impossible if we are prioritizing.
All right, and we just lost Gus Beth, and it's been happening a couple times here recently. I don't know what that's about, but we'll figure it out. We will call him right back and get him back on the line. The name of the book is America, the Possible Manifesto for a New Economy. It is published by Yale University Press. We will return with Gus Beth after this short break. Gus Beth is our guest. The name of the book, America, the Possible, a Manifesto for a New Economy. I will write a manifesto for a new phone system. Gus, thank you very much. I'm sorry we lost you there.
Well, it could have been up here in central Vermont. we have sporadic service of a lot of things.
All of a sudden, you were gone. But it's we were talking, and I think at the point where we lost you is a point that I wanted to make that you make in the book is that, look, we have really in all three of your books, you stress that environmentalism and that the environmental movement alone is not enough to change these problems. And this really has become less environmental. And the case that you make, this new economy, is to solve this is a social and economic and political issue that you argue has to be taken care of.
Look at it this way. What's an environmental issue? Well, you know, air pollution, obviously, and water pollution, and the traditional agenda that the mainline environmental groups work on. But truly, an environmental issue should be any issue that has a big effect on environmental outcomes, on environmental results. And if you define environment and environmentalism that way, you see immediately that the nature of our political system is an environmental issue. How can we possibly hope to succeed in a major way with this, you know, very flawed political system we have now, with enormous power and big money and corporations really running things? Consumerism becomes an environmental issue because clearly that drives a lot of bad results. And by consumerism, I don't mean needful consumption. I mean this extravagance, this affluenza that we actually have. How can we explain another big determinant of environmental outcomes is social inequity in the society. I mean, we have half the American families living paycheck to paycheck, just getting by, not really saving. Half the families are unable to raise $2,000 within a 30-day period if they have an emergency. About 40% of the American families have family incomes that are no more than twice the poverty threshold. So this is a tremendous inequality and economic insecurity. And one of the constant preachments of the environmental community is to get the prices right through regulation or other means to make the companies pay the full cost of their products and not push them onto the general public. The economists say to internalize the external costs, but that's going to run up prices. Putting a price on carbon, which we need to do urgently, is going to make energy more expensive. So I think in that context, it's very hard to get, with so much insecurity and people feel so threatened in their jobs and livelihoods and income stabilities. It's very hard to get people to do the things that need to be done to address the climate issue. So I think these issues go together in a very powerful way, and the mainline environmental groups have tended to adhere to the very same agenda that that we and others framed back in the 70s, an agenda of things like air pollution and water pollution and mountaintop removal, with strip mining in effect, and on and on and on, toxics issues and other things. But there really is a deeper set of causes of our environmental problems, and they involve things that are not typically defined as environmental issues. So to me, the real success will come when all the progressive communities, progressives of many stripes, come together, forge a common identity, forge a common platform, and get busy on a common basis to build the real power, including grassroots power, and getting into electoral politics. These are things that we've been poor at, really, or in the past. The progressives tend to be very much in their own silos, their community silos. I know the environmentalists are.
So how do we bring that together? I mean, how do we, the progressive movement, the Democratic Party as a whole has been known to be pretty scattershot, better over the last 6 years or so with some cohesion. But at what point do you get everybody on the same page so that they're willing, not only that 52% perhaps, but the rest of the country as well, to come on board while there are a large number of people in the country that don't believe the climate change even exists?
Well, I think it's a question of leadership.
From what level?
I think the leaders of our progressive organizations in the country, and in the book I describe a series of fields where progressives are very active, very substantial, very engaged, but almost entirely within their own fields. And if you look at the conservatives, they are much better organized, much better at meeting regularly among themselves, have stronger institutions that bring all these issues that we've been talking about together under one roof, so they can work with them in a coordinated way. They meet regularly. Well, the now notorious Grover Norquist was the person who chaired those meetings in Washington that brought all of the conservative forces together. They're much better about messaging and getting their message into the media and into the public than the progressives are. So I think we need to, I had some students do some work on this when I was a dean a few years ago, and they did a wonderful report and called this problem that said that progressives have a strategic deficit disorder. And and I think that's true. So I think part of it is leadership. It's the leaders of the various communities need to come to a realization that really we're all in the same boat. We're going to rise or fall together, and so we better get together. It's true, when progressives tend to, when one community is succeeding, whether it's, for tax justice or whether it's for environment or whether it's for jobs or rights of unions, whatever, others tend to succeed too. And the same people in the Congress are, voting positively or negatively on all of these issues. So I think there's a real need for leadership among the progressives right now. There are some things that are quite remarkable that have happened. I was recently in Madison, and your listeners may remember the huge uprising. They call it the Madison Uprising that was organized really and supported the public sector unions in the Madison, in the state capitol there. But there were hundreds of thousands of people that gathered around the Wisconsin State House, and stayed there for days, and it brought all the different progressive communities in the region together, and that still reverberates in Madison. I have a feeling that something could set it off again because they are ready to come together again. They felt that power and that joy really of having so many different communities, whether they were for civil rights or unions or environment or other social justice issues all come together. Well, that's what we need in the country. But leadership is important in building it.
I think it's fascinating to look at your career. As you mentioned, you were an advisor to President Carter. We're going back to the mid-70s as this was identified as an emerging issue. You were also an advisor to the Clinton administration. At what point, in your opinion, did we start to drop the ball in the sense of where the slippery slope gave away?
Well, I actually think that you could see the forces of reaction, so to speak, against the progressive gains that have been made in the country beginning to gel in the 70s. And, you know, I was in the Carter White House. I saw the opposition building up to a lot of the positive things that Carter wanted to do. And the date that so many people, you know, use just to have a date, I think, is 1980 with the election of President Reagan.
Right.
But you can go back. Let's just take an issue like inequality. Back in 1928, before the New Deal, the top 1% had 24% of national income. Progressive programs in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and 60s brought that percentage down to 9% from 24%. Well, starting in the late 70s and going on up to today is totally reversed. You know, we're back up to a point where the richest 1% have roughly the same amount of national income together that they had, in 1928 before the Great Depression. And this trajectory is a pattern, you know, that we've seen also in poverty. Poverty went down a lot in those more progressive decades. And then starting in the 80s, it has climbed back up now to, at least in absolute numbers, an all-time high in our country with, a sixth of the people in the country, in the Census Bureau's new measurement, in poverty. This is not some generous definition of poverty either. It's, family of four. It's pretty small potatoes, you're not going to be eating out or going to even to too many movies if you're in poverty in the United States. It turns out that if you just look at earned income, U.S. poverty is about average for the 20 most advanced countries. But those other countries do a lot more to reduce poverty through social programs and other government programs, with the result that we have the worst poverty among all of these 20 most advanced countries. Sweden reduces its poverty by 80+%. We reduce our poverty by about 30%, and we have very poor unemployment insurance, very poor coverage, very short term, we do our sort of economic support programs for people in poverty who are not working are very poor compared with other countries, and so as a result, we have a country that has the most poverty, the most inequality, the least social mobility, the worst status of women, and on and on. It is a very sad scene that we find ourselves looking at. With we're at the bottom of the 20 country heap, at the very bottom in about 30 different indicators involving health and education and environmental performance and international citizenship and social conditions. That to me is an indication that the problem is systemic. When you have so many problems, and you seem, you know, we seem so unable to come to grips with even a small number of them, much less all of them. You know, there's something fundamentally wrong with the system that we have, and so we need to transform the political economy and that we live and work in into one that really does prioritize people and place and planet. It's really hardwired, it's programmed to give us, we the people, and the places we live and the environment that we live in, the top priority, and we need to build that system. The book is all about how to do that.
The book is America, the Possible Manifesto for a New Economy. Gus Speth will be talking about the book and talking about many of the issues that he's discussed this morning tonight at the First Congregational Church in Great Barrington, an event sponsored by the Berkshire Office of the New Economics Institute. Again, the new book is America, the Possible. Gus will be in Great Barrington at 7:30 tonight. Gus, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure.
Well, thank you. This is a great opportunity, and I hope to see many of your listeners tonight.
I'm sure you will, and I thank you very much for your time. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.